6 years ago when I first was asked to be a candidate to be on executive council, and I had to write a little blurb about what would I like to do if I was on executive council. What I basically wrote as being my biggest priority would be that we enlarge our conversation in that area. I think that this is an area that's tremendously important for Christians who work in science and in engineering to be able to be a good steward of the gifts and talents God has given them. There's a verse in Luke 12:47 or 48 that says, to those to whom much has been given shall much be required. And I'd always thought of that in the sense of money, maybe to some degree time. But in fact, if I really wanted to be giving lots of money, I should have been something besides a college professor, right? I should have been something that paid off better. Not that it's a bad life being a college professor. And it was only 5 or 6 years ago that I began to feel like God was calling me to use the science and engineering background that I had, the experience, the training, and the gifts and talents that I had, to try to provide something that would be useful to people in poor parts of the world. I had spent most of my career making very high-performance, high-priced composites for the Air Force and for NASA, and the opportunity to do something on the very opposite end of the spectrum that would help poor people was something that I have become very excited about. And I think that our presentation this evening was invited with exactly that in mind. We had a session this afternoon. We'll have another one tomorrow morning. And I think for many of you probably will be thinking, as I was 5 years ago, that sounds like a great idea, but what could I possibly do? And I think that I would encourage you to really begin to pray and to ask God to help you to see areas where you might be able to use your special gifts, talents, and training to bless people in developing parts of the world. All of the R&D goes for the wealthiest billion people. And the other 6 billion or 5 billion people, simply nobody provides what I think of as thoughtful engineering services for them because they have very little discretionary income. But for those of us who are Christians, we really, I think, march to the tune of a different drummer, and we want to be responsible stewards of that. And I have come to see that some of the things that I'm working on now will ultimately, by a factor of 100, have a bigger impact on the lives of poor people in terms of their income than what I could ever have given. My biggest opportunity was not to write a little bigger check. My biggest opportunity was to think creatively about how I might be able to do something that would help provide economic opportunities in developing parts of the world. Now, one of the people who has been a great inspiration to me and a great example to me is the person who's speaking this evening, and that's exactly why I invited her to come and speak. Before I ever met Perla, I had heard of her. Somebody told me about this lady who went to Harvard and then joined the Foreign Service for the United States, not the Foreign Legion, right, the Foreign Service, served all over the South Pacific, speaks 5 languages fluently, had taken retirement and had started doing a coconut cooperative in the Philippines. So I emailed the email address I'd been given, and nothing ever came back, and so I just gave up on ever finding her until I gave a talk at our ASA chapter in Colorado on this topic, and she happened to be in Denver and heard, I don't even know how, and came, and she came up afterwards and introduced herself and said, "Hi, I'm Perla Manipal." I said, "Perla, I can't believe it. I've been trying to meet you for 2 years because she has demonstrated what can be done, and she doesn't have a formal training in engineering, but she has a heart for God to serve the poor, and she has a creative imagination on how that might be done. I have visited her coconut cooperative in the Philippines once. I've been to the Philippines twice, but only to your co-op once. I've sent students there who have spent time with her. She's come to visit now. This is, what, your third trip to Baylor? And we've just become special friends. I think what she's going to share tonight is going to be both a great inspiration to you, and I hope will be a great encouragement for you to begin to think creatively about where might God be able to use your area of training to be helpful. And it doesn't have to be a perfect match, because a lot of appropriate technology isn't really high-tech, okay? It's low enough tech that if you have a general background in science or engineering, a lot of this stuff you're very able and qualified to do. The lady who's going to be speaking to you tonight has a master's degree in foreign service or education, Perla? What is your master's degree from Harvard in?
Pardon?
Your master's degree from Harvard is in?
In graduate education.
Education, that's what I thought. Education. So here's a lady who has a master's degree in education. And you'll be very impressed with what she's doing. The biggest qualification she has and any of us has is that she cares dearly for these people. She's a great friend. Perla, come on up and share with us tonight and bless us with what you're doing as you serve the poorest of God's children, okay? Thank you for coming all the way from California. She goes to Liberia, to the Philippines, all over the place. So.
I have to make... Can you hear me? Okay. I once told my grandson, who is 14 years old, about all these laudatory words, about his grandmother during press conferences and workshops. And the first thing he told me was, "Grandma, they say things like that at funerals." So thank you, Walter. Also, don't be impressed with the title president, because as I told the Baylor group last year, my real title in this NGO in the Philippines is a CBO, and that's the chief begging officer. And Walter and Baylor have been very kind and in my capacity as CBO. And then I also found out that, you know, even if you have a degree from Harvard, you work pro bono for NGOs, and then pro bono turns out to be pro bonehead. So those are some of the lessons I have learned. But anyway, I'm going to talk to you tonight about what our NGO in the Philippines does in Liberia, and that is to teach Liberians how to add value to millions and millions of coconut trees. And this is about food security and generating livelihood and everything. But tonight, my presentation will have a little bit of a not too pleasant aspect. And that is what I would like to emphasize a little more later on, because after 2 years in Liberia, I have discovered that, good intentions are not always good intentions. And there's something about the West always saying that we know the best, and we know how to teach people in the third world how to better their lives. I'm not saying you shouldn't do these things, but there are just certain things along the way that I think we should stop to consider, that maybe our good intentions are not always good. But I'm going ahead. So my presentation is South to South approach and why it works best for, you know, country like Liberia. And our project is based on adding value to coconuts. In the Philippines or elsewhere, we call the coconut the tree of life. And 20 million Filipinos are dependent on the coconut industry. That's about 1/4 of the population. And more than 3.5 million coconut farmers in the Philippines. So you can imagine, you know, what the coconut means to these people. And these are some of the high-value products. When, you know, I was attending this, I attended the lecture this afternoon on the coconut husk, and I said, I wonder if people know that there are about 100, at least 150. And Filipinos always correct me. No, it's more, it's about 1,000. So 150, 52 commercial products out of the coconut. And the top 10 exports from the Philippines, among the top 10 exports from the Philippines, at least 5 or 6 are coconut byproducts. So these are some of the, can you read the print? Virgin coconut oil, refined coconut oil, and I have printed it in red, you know, all those products that require electricity. And I do that for a purpose, because people think that, okay, let's introduce this, let's introduce that, and then there's no electricity in the village. So, and these are some of the coconut trees I've taken pictures of in Liberia. And that is a very famous line in Liberia. In the newspapers there, they say, this too is Liberia, and then they, you know, give print pictures of scenery and then life. You know. But these are some of the coconut trees in Liberia. And that's the extent of the coconut industry in Liberia. And see that boy there? He's 11 years old. And when I told my team from the Philippines how quickly he climbed that tree without the notches, I said he climbed it in about 2 seconds. And they got their noses out of joint because they thought Filipino farmers are the best. But see, in the Philippines, we have notches on the tree. But this kid just, you know, he just hugged the tree. But then what do they do with their coconuts? You know, they just open them up and sell them in sacks of about 100. And look at those kids. You know, at an early age, you know, those girls already know how to balance those things on their heads. So I've always said that Liberian women are very level-headed. So, but this is the extent of their business in coconuts. They split it open at the top. They drink the water. And then if they feel like it, they scrape the meat and then throw everything away. That's it. And note how this nut is dehusked, because it means a lot to have clean shells. And so this is the way we do things in the Philippines, the Filipino farmer. How does he dehusk a coconut so that the shell is clean or free of fiber? And there is a purpose. There's a purpose to doing it that way, and I'll show it to you later. And this is what we call a dehusking process. And believe it or not, we took 3 of these with us from the Philippines to Liberia. So you can imagine the security people, you know, when they saw it on the x-ray. I had to go to a security, it was in Bangkok, I think, and they had just had some terrorist attack or something, and I had to convince them, I'm into coconuts, you know, these things, you know, because, you know, you see those 3 things like that, you would not think it was for coconuts. So that's how we dehusk a coconut. And this is what we did in Liberia. That's one of my teammates showing them how to do it properly. And this man is cracking open the coconut. We told them to save the water, because the water of the mature coconut can be made into organic vinegar, you know. So we don't throw anything away. And this instrument here, the grater, is very, very, very important. And again, we took a dozen to Liberia with us. That one is a different version than the one we took to Liberia. And people had never seen it. And as one Western diplomat observed, he said, "You brought that all the way from the Philippines, that kind of technology, and it's just a piece of metal and all this?" And I said, "Well, you just sit there and watch what that piece of metal does." In the Philippines, we call it a horse, caballo, you know, because we sit on that piece of board there, and then that's how you grate the coconut meat. See? You grate it, And this is a very high-value product, by the way. We call it sapal. So you squeeze out the water or the milk using ordinary water. And the milk comes out. And in the Philippines, we feed the residue of that squeezed out meat. We feed it to the pigs and the chickens and all that, and they get fat very quickly. So we went to Liberia with this mindset, oh, we're going to fatten up their chickens, because they import eggs, by the way. They import eggs in Liberia, I think from India. And I said, we're going to fatten up your chickens and all that. But then, one of my teammates happens to be an expert in food processing, and she made coconut burgers out of the ground up meat. And people were telling us, give it to the animals? No, we eat it. We eat it. And so we made cocoa burgers, and every day for lunch, we fed everybody cocoa burgers, and got to a point that two of the women are now selling cocoa burgers in school from, you know, what we taught them. And you might want to know what we make it out of. Well, of course, the grated coconut meat, and we use a little bit of cassava flour, and then some spices and salt, and we would love to use eggs, but, you know, as I mentioned, they import eggs in Liberia. So these are the first ever cocoa burgers in Liberia. And what do you do with the coconut milk? You know, we cook a lot of recipes with coconut milk. And we showed them how to cook cassava and sweet potatoes and plantains, and you stew it in coconut milk and throw in a little bit of sugar. And, you know, there's not much sugar in Liberia, so, but it's we call it ginataan. And again, that was a popular dish during our training session. Then what do you do with the milk? So you strain it. The top picture there is a plastic strainer. The bottom here, this is a part of a coconut tree we call ginit. And it works better than the plastic strainer, believe it or not. So everything from the coconut tree, you try to use. So you boil it, and the oil comes out. And that is the first ever jar of coconut oil, cooking oil, in Liberia. And then when you have the oil, something, there's a residue in the bottom. Really is a tree of life because nothing is thrown away. And that is very highly nutritious candy. Kids eat it in school. They take it in bags and, you know. So nothing is ever thrown away. And we also make oil lamps out of coconut oil. And look at the parts. That tube there, it comes from an umbrella, you know. We don't throw anything away. And, of course, an old jar, and then I guess I have to tell you what the wick was made out of. It's an old sock, and, you know, it was already ripped and everything, so they just made it into a wick, and look at it, aromatic and everything. And this is coconut candy. We try not to encourage them to cook candy because of the lack of sugar. I'll address that later. But look at the scraper. You know, it's just another one of those things, and you run it through the young coconut meat, and they out come those noodle-like things. And what do we do with the noodles? You cook them in sugar, and then this is a banana leaf. You'll be surprised how many uses a banana leaf also has. And the reason they put it on a banana leaf is that a green banana leaf, is, if exposed to heat, becomes oily, just like, you know, some of your paper here, saran wrap or whatever, and that is a delicacy. And we were talking about sugar. Liberia imports sugar, salt, eggs, tomatoes, you name it, they import everything. So we have shown them how to make coconut sugar. It's the latest rage among the health buffs in not just the Philippines, but here in the United States. I don't know if you've heard that it's now being sold here. But it comes out from the dust part of the tree we call inflorescence. And inside this little bulb here are baby coconuts. And when we teach the farmers how to do it properly, we tell them there are babies in there, and if you don't do it right, the babies die. It's like killing babies. And the first few days, you know, they didn't know whether they wanted to watch it. They didn't want to kill babies. baby coconuts, you know. And see, we even hired a bee, you know, to pose for that picture. Just that means it is sweet. The sap that comes out is sweet. But you have to bend it slowly. And we use the twine there. And then the sap comes out, and we don't throw away plastic bottles either, but we use them for that. But see, look at the baby coconuts over there. See, when the inflorescence opens. So the original purpose that the farmers had for cutting the inflorescence was to increase the yield of the tree by 25 to 30%. And so in doing that, they discovered that sap came out. Unfortunately, the farmers discovered that if you left the sap to ferment, it became a very good tasting coconut wine. And I told everybody in Liberia, I'd be darned if I'm going to teach farmers how to get drunk, you know. So we stopped at the stage where the sap is still sweet. And you boil the sap, nothing added to it. You boil the sap until it crystallizes. And just so, I don't know if you scientists ever learned that an old discarded tire is ideal for slowing down the cooling process. Because if we had placed that thing directly on the cement or the ground, it would hasten the crystallization, and then it would be too hard. So this way, it's gradual, and we are able to pulverize the the crystallized matter. And this is coconut sugar. I have brought a sample with me here, but unfortunately, I don't think it will. There's so many of you here. I was going to give a teaspoon to each one, but it's low glycemic and low sucrose content. And it's been tested in various laboratories in the Philippines, and we're now doing tests here. And we're feeding them to feeding this kind of sugar to diabetics. So now, the sad part about Liberia, charcoal. Look what they do to their trees. See? And it hurt me every time I went by a forest and saw that, but I said, I have to take a picture because I want to show people back home what cutting trees does. And we were talking about planting trees this morning. And this is how charcoal provides 90% of the energy needs of Liberia. So you can imagine how important charcoal is. So is there another way to make charcoal? Of course we do. Of course there is. Remember I told you about why it's important to dehusk the coconut so that the shell is clean? And that's what we do. And here comes the good old banana leaf again. So you put the charcoal, the coconut shells into the an empty oil drum, and you light one or two up until it ignites the rest. You cover it up. And in 24 hours, Liberia had its first ever charcoal from coconut shells. And we have done tests and comparative tests of charcoal made from coconut shells, charcoal made out of other woody matter. And coconut shell charcoal has the best qualities, high BTU. And in addition, we found out, to our dismay, to the Filipinos' dismay, that coconut shells in Liberia are thicker. And they're just so ideal for charcoal. And the thing with charcoal is you cook with it. You don't have to spend, minutes just trying to light it up. As soon as you finish cooking, it does not turn into ashes. It becomes embers. And then you can cook again. We use it for barbecuing and even drying fish and all that. So there are many, many uses of the charcoal even after it's been used for cooking. And another thing I just could not believe in Liberia was, you know, that girl and curvature of the spine, you know, from using brooms about this, you know, like that. And then we showed them how to make broomsticks that are a lot longer. And, you know, these kids came over and then showed us what they learned from our seminar, our workshop. And we distributed a lot of brooms to the households. I took this picture, these pictures, because in Liberia, 90% of labor is carried out by women. And even at a very, very young age, you know, those four girls there, I wish that I had had a wide-angle lens camera, because right next to that field, right next to them, it was a field, and the boys were playing soccer. And they were, the girls were going back and forth, helping us, you know, carry water from the well. And then this girl came over. You see how level-headed she is already? It's not easy to balance a coconut in your head. I thought at first she had a piece of cloth or something there that, you know, and I'm trying to lead on to this topic that really bothers me about Liberia. So what's wrong with that picture? Not because I'm not, the coconut lady is not wearing her San Antonio Spurs t-shirt. But do you see the irony of it? All guys, all men, we had 10 core trainers, and we were lucky to get 2 women out of the 10. And yet, the kinds of activities and work, home-based and everything, are carried out by women. So I asked the USAID contractor, I said, why guys? And so somebody said, well, the guys don't, you know, we called up one lady and her husband said that he didn't want her to go. So she did not get her husband's permission. And it was true with all the other women we asked. And I said, so what do the husbands do? Oh, they sit at home. And it's the women who go out and earn a living. I said, well, don't they realize that the women are going to be trained so they can earn a living? No, it's like talking to a wall. But that is what happened at our training. More men than women. And every time I go to villages and talk about our project and try to recruit people, about 9 out of 10 in that meeting room are men. And then I would ask, where are the women? And they said, oh, they're out in the field, they're out there, and we have to stay, the men have to stay here so they can ask questions. By the way, I'm not a raging feminist, okay? I mean, I'm just talking about what the reality is in Liberia and how ironic, if not sad, the situation is. And another irony there, after our training one evening, this woman and her neighbor, I saw them carting, a pail or a basin full of that residue, of the grated meat. And I said, where are you taking that? And they said, well, we're going to go home and cook cocoa burgers. And he said, now my family can eat more than one meal a day. And by the way, in Liberia, 80% of the households get only one meal a day. And that is the situation there. And this was why we went to Liberia, because we want to teach them that this plentiful, bountiful, natural resource that they have can provide food security for them. So what does USAID tell us? They want us to focus on jewelry and doormats. I wish it were funny, you know, because I spent time trying to convince them. I said, look, jewelry takes away the supplies and the resource for charcoal. And charcoal, compare charcoal and jewelry in the lives of Liberians. And of course, somebody told me, well, you know, you speak like a Westerner, you know. Who do you think you are? You don't think poor women also love jewelry? I said, yeah, they love jewelry, but I think they would prefer food first, you know? I mean, gee, what a... And this doormat, we were forced to make a doormat without a machine. I was talking to somebody today who had experience in the Pacific Island, and he said it took so many hours to produce fiber by pounding. And that's what we did. That's what we taught the people, how to pound the husk and everything. When they could have been making charcoal, they could have been grating meat to make oil, you know, things like that. So now my voice is rising. And then, so this is what we had to bring from the Philippines. Expensive, complicated jewelry making equipment. And of course, there's no grid electricity in Liberia. Power is so unreliable, and it fluctuates and everything. And look at this guy. He's using some of our shells for charcoal, you know, to make into jewelry bits. And it didn't take long. It didn't take long. You know, the machines broke down, and I don't know what they're going to be doing with that. And also, we have a stove. I think you made a presentation about a stove. We also have a stove that uses wood chips, rice hulls, and other kinds. It's portable, and it costs about $15. And instead of spending money, you know, to give us the opportunity to fabricate more than two stoves, they spent thousands of dollars to bring in this kind of equipment also. And this is an expeller. Yes, it's very useful. And you know, we Westerners, we always think about time. But you know how much time it, you know, for, you know, manual squeezing and this saves time. I said, fine, it saves time, but who can afford that piece of machinery? What are you going to show the people? Why are you showing the people that this thing is better than squeezing, and then all of a sudden you take that piece of machinery away from them? What's the purpose? You know, make them feel incompetent. But, you know, yes, it is very useful and everything, but it costs about $700 to $1,000. You know, I mean, yes, it is useful. But as I say, it's not accessible. It's not available. So, okay, with all my frustrations and everything, you know, even my team from the Philippines, who should have known better, but they didn't because they've never been to Liberia before, and I guess I didn't warn them early enough. When they were introducing food processing, they were always talking about something using sugar and salt. And I said, look, let's do away with that. You know, sugar is a rare commodity here. And well, what about eggs for the cocoa burgers? I said, they import eggs and even salt. They have a coastline, miles and miles and miles of coastline. And you think they would have one grain of salt in Liberia? Nope, they don't. So we are also teaching them how to make salt. So anyway, there are success factors in Liberia. And as I mentioned earlier, these hardworking women. And then, even better than many areas in the Philippines, they have cell phones. You know, anywhere, any corner of Liberia, people have cell phones. And this woman was chipping coconuts along a rural roadside. And I was asking the driver, I said, what is she doing? And she said, well, he said, she's calling her brother at the market, asking him how many more coconuts he needs. It's very good for business. Anywhere you go, you know, the remotest corners in Liberia, there are cell phones. And to me, the biggest factor, the biggest success factor is faith. And you see churches all over, different kinds. And this, by the way, was blown down by the first, you know, strong winds. But then it came up again. And it's made of coconut fronds. And there are churches all over. On Sundays, everything stops. everybody goes to church on Sundays, and somebody warned me, don't get sick on a Sunday because pharmacies will be closed and doctors don't, you know. So, but that, there are many, many missionaries in Liberia, and people go to church, and I love going to church with them because of the music and you know, just lively. And and then, of course, these women. I saw these women one day. We were driving through the coconut groves, and I saw about 15, 20 of them, and they were singing and dancing. And, of course, being the foreigner, I thought they had come to greet me. Of course not. I said to the driver, what are they doing? And they said, no, they're singing, they're asking, they're praying. They're asking God for strength and endurance. I said, why? He said, they're on their way to the beach, which was about 15 miles away. They were on foot. And I said, what are they going to do at the beach? He said, well, they're meeting 4 or 5 boats loaded with cement bags. And later on, I didn't want to take a picture of them, you know. I waited. And they came back with cement bags as heavy as 100 pounds per bag. And some of them had babies on their backs, and, you know. So praying and singing to give them strength and endurance. And I said, you know, with that kind of women, they can't fail. So, as I said, I love being in church with the Liberians. And that there's a lady, there are many lady pastors, by the way, in Liberia. And I always like to show this picture because at the end of one service, they honored me with a bunch of beautiful flowers. And the flowers were made of plastic. They were plastic flowers. And I said, in a country as verdant and you know, lush as Liberia, they give you plastic flowers? And to me, that speaks a lot about the situation in Liberia. And that's why we are there. And then, of course, when I was in the car, I flipped under the flower. There's the flowers, and it said, made in China. In the Philippines, we have a saying, God made the world, everything else is made in China. And I was never so shocked to see, you know, plastic flowers made in China. So this is the summary of our message. Small-scale value adding of an abundant, untapped natural resource. And please, let's keep technology simple, bottom-up, and applicable to local conditions. And you cut costs by recycling bottles, bags, you name it. And then, of course, introducing the clean and green processes. Before we get on to the next, I would like to add, I think another, I should add in there that for any developmental aid to be successful, you know, people talk about the basic goodness and generosity of Americans, but after my experience in Liberia, I would like to add 2 virtues there, or maybe a little less hubris. You know, we don't know everything. We don't always have the solutions to their problems. And number 2, maybe a little more wisdom. And that's what I really hope and pray for our whatever we do in the developing world. And so to close my presentation, I always like to present our mascot. See, in the Philippines, when you make a boo-boo in school, the teacher says, always use your coconut. And this must be the world's cheapest logo because I ran a contest at a local high school, and I told them to draw a logo for our project. And the winner won the equivalent of $1. And at first, Coco Pete was left-handed. You know, he was using his left hand. And I said, why is Coco Pete using his left hand? He said, because you are left-handed. He wanted to honor me. And then I took the original drawing back here, brought it here in the United States, and had my grandson color it. So that is a very, very special logo for me. So this is all about us, and I don't know if you can read it, but I welcome your questions. Yes? Being there?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, we always ask questions like, are there roads? Is there electricity? Water? You know, these kinds of very basic questions and everything. And what do people eat? Or what is their, how do they cook? You know, things like this you ask. And then, of course, the best thing really is to go there and see for yourself. And don't have any presumptions that, oh, I'm going to bring this x-ray machine to this village because they need, then of course this happened in my village in the Philippines. A big-hearted U.S. company came and brought in all this hospital equipment, and up to now they're still in a warehouse because we don't know how to, you know, set up the electricity requirements and everything. So, but that's an extreme case. But that is my advice. Yes?
If I understood you correctly, you said that you thought when you went there that you could give some of this coconut meal to the chickens and animals to get fat and you would have four eggs. But then you said the Liberians didn't like this idea.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
it wasn't that they didn't like it. They just discovered, why feed the animals first when we are hungry? That's what they were trying to tell us.
But could they not, over some period of time, be persuaded that perhaps a portion could go to the animals so they don't have to import eggs?
Yes. Yes, well, in fact, thank you for raising that question, because there's a young man here in the audience, and he's been helping us fashion out a business plan for an integrated coconut processing facility, because that's really the only way to go. And when we have this integrated plant, you know, it goes all the way from the coconut, the raw coconut, to oil, and then all the other byproducts, there will be plenty of that waste coconut meat. That, and in fact, this young man here, he's a graduate of Baylor, helped us prepare a business plan for a poultry industry. So we are including that. And we do plan to, increase the activity, the coconut value-adding activity, so that we will have the volume required to also put up the poultry industry. Yes. In fact, I have also been working with a group funded by the U.S. government that does, you know, solar lamps and solar heaters. But there was a problem about the panels. I mean, does your cooker use a panel? A solar? Ah.
Mm-hmm.
you like to come and join us? No, really. I mean, that sounds... I mean, these are exactly the kinds of ideas we want, you know. This, you don't need high tech. Yes, sir? I can't hear you too well. Yeah. Yes.
Pieces of metal, or we decide, I hit it, you're going to industrialize it instead. Mm-hmm. Better to build a factory.
Well, we're going to do both. In fact, I'm also glad that you mentioned that, because what I forgot, because I was getting a little angry there, you know, the money that we spent for bringing in the jewelry making equipment, it cost almost $10,000, and then the metal expeller. And I made a calculation and showed it to USAID and said, look, do you know how many of these dehuskers, and you could distribute them to so many households? And they didn't get that, you know. And it looks good at trade fairs, you know, to show jewelry out of coconut shells and doormats and the first ever in Liberia. And then when people ask, are they making this now? Are they producing it? In the next phase, you know? And that's why we want to do it both at home, the cottage industry, and also as a business. Can I quote you on that? Yes, sir. According to the manual that we, distributed, coconuts are all over the world. And you see, because they float and they go from shore to shore and everything, and whatever climate and soil are you know, beneficent to them, they grow. And that's why most of them are on the coast. So, but they have plenty of coconuts. And as my team found out, they have better meat and better charcoal, better chefs than the ones we have in the Philippines. So. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I submitted a report a couple of weeks ago. And I said that one of the most important factors for us in Liberia is what we call the bully pulpit. And I always have two pastors with me, one female and one male. And I talk, and my team members talk, and there's always a pastor, you know, telling them in their language and all that. And I tell you, when the pastor tells them, sweep the floor and do the dishes and this and that, they do it. Yes, we very much include the church. And in fact, we're working with a women's group. They call the Charity Prayer Band. And they're cooking oil, they're making coconut oil at home, and they're selling them and making oil lamps and everything. But it's always through the church. Yes. Yes. Pardon? I tell you, I always have arguments with them, like, you know, say, well, you know, we have to stay for these meetings because it's only the men who know how to ask questions. Yep, they told me that. And then at the office, the men always laugh when I say that. But the people who climb trees in Liberia are men. But, yes, go ahead. Oh, I wish I knew. Well, what happened was a friend of mine had come to the Philippines. He was working on a project for another USAID contractor, and he was very impressed with what we were doing in the Philippines. And then a few years later, there was a project for I mean, after the Civil War, Liberia has been inundated with billions of aid money, and that's not always good, you know, and that's another story. And one of the projects that the U.S. government is pursuing, continuing to pursue right now in Liberia, is rural electrification using renewable energy. And this friend of mine is into biomass energy, biomass-based energy, and he said, you know, Liberia has coconuts. Why don't? And that's the long, you know, that's the short story of how I got involved in Liberia. It's been one of my most difficult assignments because, you know, you see the poverty and the hunger, and then I don't have a chance to transition between that and going back to opulent California, where people throw things away, including my children, my grandchildren, and, you know, to throw food away. And I tell my grandchildren, you know, grandma once threw away a candy wrapper. I was eating something in the jungles in Liberia, and when the wrapper fell on the ground, a lot of kids grabbed the wrapper and started licking it. And I said, here you are throwing food that, you know, I still can't get used to it. And it's not an easy job. It's not an easy job. But then you see those women praying and then singing, and somehow they are strengthened and all that. And I said, you know, I will continue. I'll continue. Yes. Well, we're continuing. Somebody from one of the contractors in Liberia attended one of our training sessions, and he could see the potential. Not even a potential. You know, it really is there. The reality that coconuts will make good business in Liberia. So we are going to be, I insisted, I said, I want to work with a private company. I don't want to go through this, you know, bureaucratic, whatever, red tape and all that. And I want to work with the private sector. And of course, the church. And so that's what we're putting together right now. We're putting up this, I'm working with three businessmen. And one of them is a pastor, by the way, and he's into business. That's okay. And I told him, just don't make sure you don't use the collections, you know, for capital infusion or whatever. But we're working on putting up this oil mill, this mini oil mill, with all the byproducts that will be donated to the community. So that's our next project. Please pray for us.
Tell him just briefly, you work in the Philippines, how many jobs you've created, and about the past communism and the Muslim.
Yeah, well, in the Philippines, we have, you know, it never ceases to amaze me how resourceful the poor coconut farmers are in the Philippines. And this is an aside. I was talking to some coconut farmers in the Philippines one evening. I was telling them what I was doing in Liberia. And I noticed one of them had a sharp knife with him, and he was whittling on a piece of bamboo and all that. And then 15, 20 minutes later, he comes up with that scraper, the meat scraper made out of bamboo. And so we have this cooperative, a small coconut farmers cooperative in this province in Aklan. And they have an oil mill. And they invited us to work with them because they said, we don't know what to do with thousands of coconut husks. They have something like 2,000 coconuts a day. And he said, we don't know what to do with all these husks. And so we worked with them in forming a business, an enterprise. And at its height, we employed 750 families, you know, just for processing the fiber into twines, making them into ropes. And then the ropes were made into doormats and you know, nets for for soil erosion control, and then it was replicated in other parts of the Philippines, and some of our members are former communist insurgents, and in the beginning it was kind of scary because about 6 o'clock in the evening, the leader of this communist group came, and they had all these arms with them, and he said, here we go, goodbye, have I written my will and all that. And the first thing they did, was they just dropped. This was at the office of the village chief or his home. They just dropped all the weapons there, and they said, "We want jobs." That's what they did. I still get goosebumps because I was really scared. We want jobs. So I know that this is true anywhere in the world. And in Liberia right now, there's a lot of crime and all that. And the men came to our training and everything. And one of them said, "I've stopped drinking." I said, "Good, because I don't want any drunks, doing this kind of work." And in the Philippines, it's a Catholic country, right? My sister is a nun, and she always warns me when I go into this community development where, don't ever talk about family planning, So when we were teaching the women how to twine, this is in the Philippines, to do the rope making, and you have to have a pail full of fiber. And I just told the women, if you're pregnant, how are you going to reach, the ropes? Very subtle way. So, a year later, or 2 years later, some journalists came and watched the women operate and everything. And one woman goes to a journalist, and we don't tell them what to tell the journalists. She said, and this was on TV, and this is how my sister found out that I disobeyed her. Because the woman said to the journalist, "See my three-year-old boy there? If it were not for this project, he would have two other siblings." So my sister calls me a couple days later and said, "What did you tell that woman? Why did she not have two more children?" I said, How did you find out? And, but these kinds of things. And so we've stopped smoking. We've stopped the practice of smoking among the men because we tell them, if you smoke, you're going to burn the fiber. See? And then, of course, the women and all that. So these are the side effects. And this is what we want to replicate because we know that what exists in the Philippines, a developing country, also can be applicable to another developing country. So that's the message I have. Thank you, everybody.
Let me mention.